All right, so our last talk of the day, plundering the Egyptians, and this is probably a perspective on Edwards that you will not hear many places, very different from the first two sessions. We're not going to look at a specific work, but rather we're going to look at Edwards' thought as a whole from a particular angle and perspective. And the title of the talk, Plundering the Egyptians, Edwards' Subversive Exploitation of Modernism, or of the Enlightenment. Perhaps you know this allusion. Plundering the Egyptians is probably not a very common phrase today, but it used to be within the church, and it comes from the book of Exodus. Three or four times in the book of Exodus, as God, either in the act of delivering the Egyptians or predicting it ahead of time, God reveals through Moses that the Egyptians and Pharaoh will not only let his people go, but on the way out they're going to get the goods. And they're going to take the silver and the jewelry and the gold and the treasure of Egypt with them to the promised land. So here's a passage at the end of Exodus 3 which predicts that this will happen. The Lord speaks through Moses, "But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it." And of course, the following chapters detail that. "After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, and so you shall plunder the Egyptians." Now, the early church fathers, who were largely the early church thinkers, who were largely not Jewish, but Gentiles who came from pagan backgrounds, found this to be an apt metaphor for what they did when they converted to Christianity, that they came out of pagan Greco-Roman philosophy, but they did not come empty out of it. But they took the treasures within it, and they converted it for the Lord's use. And so the basic idea here that we'll talk about, that I think Edwards is an enormously helpful and creative and genius example of, but also one that applies to all Christians, not just theologians and thinkers, is this idea that Christianity is somewhat unique among all the religions of the world, and that it's just inherently translatable and adaptable to every culture. And so we'll talk about this. Let's start with the Michael McLennan quote at the top of your handout. This phrase that he starts with, the implicit apology, I know you don't know what that means yet. We will come back to it. It's a perspective. It's a strategy that he perceives, I think, rightly in much of Edwards' writings. And here's what he says about it. "The implicit apology is something distinctive to Jonathan Edwards. It was an exceptionally ambitious endeavor since he, Edwards, sought to use every conceivable form of reasoning, metaphysical, moral, experiential, historical, in a many-sided effort to establish the centrality and the supremacy of God. With the phrase implicit apology, I refer to Jonathan Edwards' subtle strategy throughout his corpus, it's in all of his writings to one degree or another, to appropriate and reinterpret various styles of thought or genres of writing so as to make them conform to his fundamental Christian convictions. He baptized every 18th century idea in intellectual tradition he could lay his hands on." Norman Fiering, another Edwards scholar, writes that his purpose, contrary to that of the Enlightenment philosophers of the day, was to turn the best thought of his time to the advantage of God. He turned the tables on the Enlightenment, or plundered the Egyptians, to use the language of the early Christian writers. "The profane reasonings of the salons and the coffee houses were converted ad maiorem Deo gloriam. The implicit apology appears in such varied writings as A Divine and Supernatural Light, as a sermon, The Mind, the philosophical tract he wrote very early on, two dissertations we spoke about earlier, and The History of Redemption, a sermon series. In the implicit rather than explicit apology, Edwards engaged not the specific apologetic issues of his time, but rather whole traditions of thought that he wished to interpret or reinterpret. To see the implicit apology, one must read between the lines." And this is why it's so hard to see, that you need to know how the people of the day were speaking to see that Edwards is doing this. And because Edwards lived in a very distant time, most of us do not talk or think in the categories that the Enlightenment philosophers did 300 years ago. So we will break this down, look at some examples not only in Edwards, but in Scripture where you see this, in the early church, but then try to focus on practically what does this look like today for us as believers. And it is somewhat ironic that it was not in mind when I prepared this, but Jesse and I both feel like this. I think In my limited grasp of the Western church as a whole, the person in today's church in the West who does this the best is Tim Keller, right here in New York City. This is at the heart of Tim Keller's genius, that he can talk in the language and the categories of the day, but reinvent it with Christian content from within. And so I think Tim Keller very much falls in an Edwardsian line here. However, there always have been, and there continue to be, dissenting voices in the early church, in the church, and there were in the early church, about this, and we'll look at some of those today. But Tertullian, a famous early church father, didn't like this strategy. So he said famously, "What indeed has Athens to do with Jerusalem, philosophy with theology? What concord is there between the academy and the church? What between heretics and Christians?" And of course, he's alluding to 2 Corinthians 6, "Come out of them, separate." "Away with all attempts to produce a modeled Christianity of Stoic, Platonic, and dialectic composition." So Tertullian, when you become a Christian, you leave that behind, you abandon it. It's pagan, it's displeasing to God. However, that was not the majority view among most early Christian thinkers. And in a book that's on the recommended reading at the end of this essay, at the end of this handout, is this wonderful, wonderful work about the intellectual life of the early church called The Spirit of Early Christian Thought by Robert Lewis Wilkin. And he examines 10 or 11 facets of the thought and the thinking and the life of the early church. And one of the things that he comes back to again and again, I just included two quotations, but he continually comes back to that, to this. "One observes again and again that Christian thinking in the first 4 or 5 centuries, while working within patterns of thought and conceptions that were rooted in Greco-Roman culture, nonetheless transformed them so profoundly that in the end, something new came into being." What he means is if you had no familiarity with the difference between Christianity and secular philosophy of the day, on the surface, the early Christians sounded very similar because they used the same language and the same categories, but what they meant by them was radically different. And he says also, "Although early Christian thinkers worked within a Greek and a Roman tradition of moral philosophy that preceded them, they transformed what they had received. So on the one hand, they did not abandon it, they did not isolate themselves from it, but on the other hand, they did not succumb to it and just say, oh, you win, we're just going to say what you say. But instead, they took the external categories, but filled it with new content and redeemed it from the inside. And so missiologists and theologians often call this contextualization, that when the gospel comes into a new culture, and we know, because our culture has reminded us, and probably rightly so, that Western Christians in the last 300 or 400 years have often done this poorly. That we've gone to the African villages and asked them to dress up like Europeans and to sing European hymns and to recite European confessions, and all under the impression of, but that's just Christianity, without any self-awareness that, no, it's your Christianity in a European form. And one of the things that is increasingly being recognized is Christianity in a way that no other religion or philosophy. So, for instance, in Islam, it is, even though you can find liberal Muslims who would want to back away from this, traditional Islam, you are not supposed to translate the Quran into another language. You dilute it as soon as you do that. If you are a traditional Jewish person, you must become Jewish to enter Judaism. You must be circumcised and obey the Torah. And Paul, of course, argues against that in Galatians and Romans. In Christianity, instead, there is, in every culture, it produces a completely, in one sense, different phenomenon, but in another sense, there is a spirit that is unified among all of it. And so Christianity is very unique here, and Andrew Walls, one of the leading missiologists of the last century from Scotland, says this: "It is in the moments of transition when the gospel goes from one society or culture to another, the process of diffusion of the gospel across cultural boundaries, the points at which cultural specificities change, that the distinctive nature of the Christian faith becomes manifest in its developing dialogue with culture. The process is clearly visible already within the New Testament itself," and I think that's absolutely true, that this is not a post-New Testament phenomenon that's just independent, but it's already going on there. "In order to explain in the Greek world who Christ is and what he did and does, a new conceptual vocabulary had to be constructed. Elements of vocabulary that already existed in that world had to be commandeered and turned towards Christ." So they did not say, you know, if you want to become a Christian, you have to learn our language, and then you can become a Christian. Instead, speak in their language, but mean new things by it, and describe Jesus in that language. Now today, for those of us who are conservative in our theological orientation, more orthodox, one of the mistakes that you often see today is this extreme a polemical reaction to the liberal tendencies of much Christianity in the last 300 years is an extreme reaction the other way of C.S. Lewis complains in many of his essays that in the Anglican, in the Church of England of his day, that he would often see priests and leaders in the church who did the same thing that we're talking about, but on a liberal side, that they would still use Orthodox language, but they would mean completely different things by it. And the lay people in the churches heard what they wanted to hear, but not what they meant, and that they were leading people astray. And the reaction to that has often been what Richard Lentz calls the fundamentalist fallacy in isolation, or at least a naivete. He says this, the fundamentalist fallacy is the conviction that God reveals himself outside of a cultural setting to communicate timeless truths to people who themselves are not influenced by their own cultural setting. And of course, this is exactly what happened when the European Christians came to Africa. We see the gospel as it is, period. And so whatever we're conveying to you is just the gospel, not our cultural baggage. And this is one of the reasons, and maybe I'll ruffle some feathers here, you should always take it with a big dose of suspicion when someone claims that they come from a Bible-believing church. Now, it's great to be a Bible-believing church, but what they mean is our interpretation of the Bible-believing church. And it's almost like we avoid our cultural presuppositions, we avoid our biases, and we see things as they are, is what they mean by that. And that's just not true. And so one of the things that conservatives today tend to be especially susceptible to is a lack of self-awareness that we are always interpreting. Now, it doesn't mean that there's no objectivity, you can't see things as they are to some extent, but we are always interpreting. We are always looking at things as Western modern Americans in ways that people from the rest of history would not have found obvious. So one point that I think Edwards gets is that the gospel is always clothed in the culture it inhabits, for better or for worse. So the reality is not, do you want to do contextualization, but rather, do you want to do it well or you want to do it poorly? That's the question. And you will do it one way or the other. It's inevitable. The only question is, will it be done well, faithfully, creatively, or poorly, unbiblically, and naively? One of the most helpful and provocative modern Christian writers on these themes that I've ever read is Leslie Newbegin. I highly recommend his writings. This book, Foolishness to the Greeks, I list in the recommended reading at the end here. And he says this, first time I read this years ago, this blew my mind. It just gave me new categories. He says, in speaking of the gospel, I am, of course, referring to the announcement that in the series of events that have their center in the life, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, something has happened that alters the total human situation and must therefore call into question every human culture that the gospel comes into. Now, clearly, however, this announcement is itself already culturally conditioned. You know, this is why in very conservative seminaries, you know, I've heard it, the students will come in and when they start learning Greek and Hebrew, they think like Greek and Hebrew are more inspired languages than other languages. That the assumption is that somehow the original version of Christianity was not culturally conditioned, and it's only subsequent passing transpositions of it into other cultures where that happened. What he's saying is the gospel came in a Greco-Roman culture that was already as biased and as human as any other. So it does not come down from heaven or by the mouth of an angel, neither at the beginning, even in the New Testament, nor at any subsequent time, is there or can there be a gospel that is not embodied in a culturally conditioned form of words. The idea that one can or could at any time separate out by some process of distillation a pure gospel unadulterated by any cultural accretions is an illusion. There's never an acultural gospel. It is, in fact, an abandonment of the gospel, for the gospel is about the Word made flesh, incarnation. God took on a cultural particularity when he made himself known to us. Every statement of the gospel in words is conditioned by the culture of which those words are a part. And every style of life that claims to embody the truth of the gospel is a culturally conditioned style of life. And so holiness to one set of Christians in one age just seems more obvious that certain things should and should not be done than in Christians to another age. And so, for instance, Luther and Calvin seemed to think that having a good time at the pub was a form of holiness, and many Southern Baptists today think it's the opposite of holiness. And what's different there is not necessarily theology, but cultural differences. Yet the gospel, which is from the beginning to the end embodied in culturally conditioned forms, calls into question all cultures, including the one in which it was originally embodied, including the Greco-Roman world, or including the Hebrew culture of the Old Testament. And so this tension that we'll return to, that the gospel is always saying both yes and no to every culture it comes into. It's both at home and a stranger within every culture it's in, is something that we must realize. And so one of the best steps that anyone can take is just becoming aware of this. Just becoming aware of this, that you look at all reality through glasses. Again, it doesn't mean that everything's relativistic. It doesn't mean that everything's up for grabs. But just to say, we always have perceptions that we would not have unless I was a white, middle-class guy from New Jersey who grew up in the 20th century. That has a lot to do with why I look at the world the way I do. One thing I want to do is mention some, moving to number one, some examples within Scripture itself of believers taking what was already there in the surrounding pagan culture and turning it to the advantage of divine truth. And so divine truth is in an inspired way spoken, but in categories that were already there and now were to some degree fallen. One that has become very well known, at least in the academy, if not in the church, over the last 200 years, is as all of the old pagan creation myths and stories have been discovered, Enuma Elish, Gilgamesh, all of these, is there are striking similarities to Genesis 1 and 2 in these stories. And almost everyone, conservative or liberal, would say they are not accidental. And the other thing, especially if you think Moses had a part to do with writing Genesis, then clearly the Genesis account is much, much later than all these other ones. So what almost every biblical scholar, orthodox or unorthodox, would say today is that the book of Genesis, the creation story, is a polemical reaction to the pagan creation myths of the culture. And so I'll give you a few examples. In all of the creation stories of the ancient Near East, human beings, their purpose in creation is always connected to some degree to work. That we're created to work. That everybody gets that in the ancient Near East. But so there's a similarity. The difference is, in almost all the other creation myths, we're created to work because the gods are tired of working, they want a party, and so they create us as a race of slaves to do their work for them. Whereas, what is the vision that's given in Genesis 1 and 2? We work because we're in the image of God, and God works. And then we rest after we work because God rests after us. So work is something good. It's something that has dignity. It's something that reflects God, not a burden that God wants to get off. And I don't want to get sidetracked in Genesis 1 and 2. I find this so fascinating and important to understand what these chapters are actually doing. But one of the differences you see between the biblical account, in my view, and all the pagan accounts is all the pagan accounts are exactly what you would think if you started with fallen, sinful experience and then read that back into the heavens. So, for instance, I don't want to get up tomorrow, Monday morning, and go to work. It's burdensome. I'd rather sleep. I'd rather do what I want. And so, work sucks. So therefore, the gods are like that too. And they created us to do what they don't want to do either. That's exactly what you would think if you start from human experience. And so many others could be spoken. In all the pagan creation stories, to some degree or another, all human beings are not created in the image of God. Only the kings, or only men, or only the aristocratic priestly class. But here in Genesis 1-2, not only are men and women, but even implicitly, Gentiles as well, not just Jews. And so it's a very, very different. Now, that wouldn't stick out to you if you didn't know that it's responding to categories that have already arisen. And I could give many, many more examples of what goes wrong. One other. In almost all the creation accounts, every creation account is trying to answer the question, what is wrong with the world? Everybody guesses something's wrong with it. In almost all the ancient Near Eastern pagan creation stories, what's wrong with the world is either another race or the gods were already fighting before they created the world. And the world is the spillover of a cosmic war that predated the human race. Only in the biblical account do you get the world was created out of a good, peaceful state. It was once good. And the problem is us. Now, that wouldn't stick out to you as much or not as poignantly if you didn't understand that the language, the categories, the phrases are eerily similar in all of these stories. And when you read it in light of it, it becomes very clear. Genesis is responding to those views saying, we're going to talk like you, but we're going to deliver a very different message than you about who the true God is, what the real problem is, what the solution is. And it's in the content that the differences come, not in the cosmology, which I think is a very important thing. Many other Old Testament examples could be mentioned. I think that's just the most prominent one. In the New Testament, you see so many examples after the incarnation. One is this, Paul in Acts 17, where he comes to the Areopagus in Athens, and he preaches. If you want to dig into this more, a great thing to do is go home and read through the book of Acts sometime and isolate all the sermons that Paul or Peter delivered to Jews in the synagogue, and then on the other side, put all the sermons they delivered to Gentiles in the streets. Now, two things you'll notice. On the one hand, the basic storyline and narrative is the same. Sin, judgment, death and resurrection of Christ. On the other hand, the way you get there, to the Jews you argue from the Old Testament, to the Gentiles you argue from natural revelation, the categories and the languages used, Christ, Messiah, God, Lord, things like that, with respect to the audiences, that the Gentiles were already, the Greeks were already using these categories, and so they speak differently to them. And in Acts 17, I think that's very, very true. Couple of specific examples. Here's one that I find very interesting. Romans 1, 18 through 32, long diatribe about what's wrong with human beings. Our idolatry, the wrath of God is being revealed against us for exchanging God's glory for the things that he's made. All these things. Again, this is not popularly known in the church. Any good commentary you read on Romans 1, 18 through 32 will point this out. Paul is ripping off an earlier Jewish document there called the Wisdom of Solomon. Not just in terms of the overall categories, but the language and the wording comes from about 8 chapters in the Wisdom of Solomon, which predates Romans, and which was a non-Christian Jewish document of the early first century. And so what we think is distinctive there is actually Paul agreeing with other Jews. Yeah, idolatry is the problem. Yeah, Gentiles go astray from God. And the kicker comes in that the Wisdom of Solomon gives a big therefore to this argument and says, but the Jews are not like this. And in Romans 2:1, Paul says, but before you, O man, turn to judge someone else, remember that you do the very same things. And chapter 2 is the punchline. It's the Jews are indicted as well as the Gentiles. And you wouldn't get that that specific understanding of the passage. That's what Paul's after. Everyone in the first century, if you're Jewish, agrees that the Gentiles are dirty dogs. What they don't agree on is that the Jews are also in that boat that's sinking. And that's what Paul points out by using the language and the terminology of Wisdom of Solomon, but then by saying, oh, and the Jews too. Where the Wisdom of Solomon says, not the Jews. And so becomes very crucial to see how he's doing that. This is a very polemical thing. Gospel of John, I would imagine you're somewhat familiar with it. Logos language, word. Philo uses it, Greco-Roman theology, Aristotle and Plato use it at times. And on the one hand, it clearly has an Old Testament background. The Hebrew word for word is debar. And in the Old Testament, God's word creates. God's word is a part of him. So on the one hand, there's the Old Testament background. But on the other hand, there's clearly an eye to this rationality in Greco-Roman philosophy that's understood to be the essence of all things. And it's responding to that by saying, Jesus is what you're looking for. Jesus is the logos, not reason. And so one that scholars such as N.T. Wright and others are increasingly pointing out today is that much of the salvific language in the New Testament is exactly the same as what the imperial cult used, which is Rome. So that, for instance, euangelion is a Greek word for gospel. The Christians didn't make that word up. It was already in use by the Romans that whenever Caesar went and defeated another country, they came back to the road and they had a big parade to declare the euangelion of Caesar's victory. So it was the good news of a victory over a hostile power. And Caesar would be worshipped, proskeneo, by the people after that. And Rome had ambitions that all the nations would come under the banner of Rome, not just this one. And Caesar is Lord was the core confession that you're supposed to make as a Roman citizen. So if you remember, Paul in the book of Acts gets in trouble at one point in trial. The accusation is he says that there is another king besides Caesar. And they don't like that. So what's he saying? Everyone in his culture is saying Caesar is Lord, and Paul saying Jesus is Lord. So again, we don't get that because we don't walk around saying, you know, Obama is Lord. That's not our language. But if somebody walked around and said Jesus is president, you would hear that in light of our use of this language today. So understanding these things, a couple of other examples I won't go into, but you can look at that on your own. In the early church, again, Robert Louis Wilkins says, the early Christians, they got this. They followed the New Testament example of not reinventing the wheel, not in a sectarian way inventing a new language that other people couldn't understand, but rather, for Christians, the moral life and the religious life were complementary. Although thinking about the moral life moved for Christians within a conceptual framework that was inherited from Greek and Latin moralists. They used the same vocabulary. Christian thinkers redefined the goal of virtue by making fellowship with the living God the end, not happiness abstractly considered like Aristotle. Revised the beginning by introducing the biblical teaching that we are made in the image of God, and then complicated the middle with talk of the intractability and inevitability of sin. Same language, new storyline underneath the language. without an understanding of the ancient moralists, Aristotle, Seneca, Cicero, Epictetus, one cannot enter the world of early Christian ethics. You won't understand what they're talking about because they're in conversation with the society of the day. Yet, if you did know all those secular philosophers, as soon as one takes in hand the essays of Clement or Tertullian or Ambrose or reads the sermons of Gregory of Nyssa or Augustine, it's clear, even though they sound the same, something new is going on. They don't mean the same things as the culture around them. And so this is a very crucial thing, and also very widely practiced throughout Christian history. Number two, various models. This is my own breakdown. Maybe you find it helpful, maybe not. You could argue that others should be included or there should be subcategories, whatever. But just four different ways that all of these models have to do with how do you understand the relationship between the confessing Christian church and the unbelieving culture in which that church always finds itself inhabiting, regardless of what the culture happens to be. One model or response is isolation. Let's have a new society. Let's get away from all the people in New York City who are so evil, and let's go to Alabama and set up a new society there. Let's pull away from them. And so the separation of the New Testament is understood rather than a spiritual separation within the midst of the city of man. It's understood as a physical and social separation. I don't even want to be around you. And this, of course, is the legacy of much of conservative fundamentalism over the last 150 years and what Billy Graham and Fuller Seminary were reacting against when they raised their voices of protest in the mid-1900s. So this is just, we're just going to talk our own language to each other, forget about everybody else. Another one, and these middle two, in my view, are both correct. I think they're both orthodox. The second one is external transformation, by which I mean the language that you're using is still explicitly the language of the Bible, but you are talking in conversation with unbelievers, challenging them, listening to them, but the categories you're using are explicitly sin, redemption, righteousness, whatever, and I think that's absolutely biblical. So it's similar to isolation in the sense that we're still just using our own rhetoric. We're still just using our own language, but we're in conversation with others and we are engaging them on their ground. That's absolutely legitimate. A third one, and this is where I think Edwards is so helpful. This is what McClemond in that earlier quote means by Edwards' implicit apology, is what I would call internal transformation, in which the starting point, at least linguistically, is the way people already talk in the culture and already think, and adopting that, but then inserting a new story into it, but communicating in the rhetoric of the day. So that from the outside, if someone from another culture would come and look, you would look exactly like all the unbelievers in the way that you talk, but you would be meaning something very different by it. And that's what we want to spend the rest of our time on. The fourth one, of course, is liberal surrender. Not only talk in the language of the world, but just mean exactly what the world means. And if anything, then turn around and baptize Christian language and fill it with secular content. Karl Barth, in his Dogmatics and Outline, his short version of his Dogmatics, I think strikes the right balance here. He says, God's congregation, that is the people of God, possessed and at all times possesses its own language. We do. Nothing can change this. For it has in history its own special history, its own special road. It speaks when it confesses in relation to this special history. We start from the Bible. It stands in the quite special concrete historical context, which has at all times formed its language and will continue to form it. Therefore, the language of faith, the language of public responsibility, in which as Christians we are bound to speak, will inevitably be the language of the Bible. There is a specifically church language. We have to start from the Bible and talk like that. That is in order. Let us call it by the familiar name by saying that there is a language of Canaan, of the Promised Land. And when the Christian confesses his faith, when we have to let the light that is kindled in us shine, no one can ultimately avoid speaking in this language. For this is how it is. If the things of Christian faith, if our trust in God and His Word, is to be expressed precisely, so to speak in its essence, and time and again, it is bitterly necessary for this to be done, so that things may be made clear, then it is inevitable that all undaunted the language of Canaan should sound forth unapologetically. One thing is certain, that where the Christian church does not venture to confess in its own language, it usually does not confess at all. So that sounds very traditional there, but then he turns the page, turns the corner, and he says that this cannot be the end of the matter. The church's language cannot aim at being an end in itself. It must be made clear that the church exists for the sake of the world and that the light is shining in the darkness, not away from it. Where confession is serious and clear, it must be fundamentally translatable into the speech of Mr. Everyman, the man and woman in the street, into the language of those who are not accustomed to reading scripture and singing hymns, but who possess a quite different vocabulary in quite different spheres of interest. By the very nature of the Christian church, there is only one task, to make the confession our own language heard in the sphere of the world as well in their language. Not now repeated in the language of Canaan, but in the quite sober, quite unedifying language which is spoken out there. There must be translation, for example, into the language of the newspaper. It doesn't say here, but Karl Barth is famous for his claim that every preacher to be faithful should have the Bible in one hand and the local paper in the other when he preaches on Sunday morning. Almost every time, the first 5 or 6 years after I became a Christian, almost every time I heard an evangelical allude to that, it was in a negative way. And I just think, I would go this far. I think you're unfaithful if you don't think that that's true. That you can just ignore what is going on in the world and just talk in the language of the Bible. I think that's not biblical. And so there must be translation, for example, into the language of the newspaper. What we have to do is to say in the common language of the world the same thing that we say with each other in the forms of Christian language. If a man cannot, let him consider whether he really knows how to speak edifyingly, even in the church, because maybe it's just rhetoric then. Maybe you don't even know what you're saying to other Christians at that point if you can't translate it into another language. We know this language of the pulpit and the altar, which outside the area of the church is as effectual as Chinese. And we all know that we have our little Christianese, and we bring others in, and they're like, what is going on here? It's just, this is a foreign language to me. So, moving to Edwards. Some ways that we see this in Edwards, I have a number of quotes just to, I'm not going to read many of these, but just to assure you that I'm not making this up, many scholars see that Edwards is doing this. Just a couple of here, Norman Fearing. In the late 17th century, moral philosophy had begun, I love this quote, begun the process of converting into secular and naturalistic terms crucial parts of the Christian heritage. So there are still, you read, this is one of the reasons, and I'll probably really ruffle feathers here, why so many conservative Christians today can still be deluded into thinking that the founding fathers were primarily Orthodox Christians. Because you read them and they sound like Orthodox Christians, but they mean something different, most of them do. They're very deistic, they're very, they've already started the slide, the descent, and it's because they're still using the language and we give them the benefit of the doubt. Oh, so you mean what I mean by that, but they don't. So they're already assimilating it. Edwards, in a sense, reversed the ongoing process by assimilating the moral philosophy of his time, their language, and converting it back into the language of religious thought and experience. So you read Edwards, and it sounds like he's a heretic. It sounds like he means the same thing as all the pagans do, but he's Christian in doing it. David Brand says it might not be too far from the mark to say that Edwards used the language of, and we'll get to some of these examples in a second, psychological empiricism and religious affections, incorporated the metaphysical language of Neoplatonism in the end for which God created the world, nature of true virtue, and then he filled the idioms in both cases with theological content consistent with Calvin. So on the surface, he sounds like he's saying the same thing, but it's just Calvinism repackaged. It's just Orthodox Christianity, to some extent, repackaged. Jump down to the final quote there by David Brand. This is the one I want to leave us with as we look at particular ones. Edwards' prophetic challenge to the church today involves redeeming the secular idiom. I love that sentence. That is one of Edwards' prophetic challenges us today to interact with the world the way he did and to redeem the secular idiom, not to condemn it, not to avoid it, but to redeem it from the inside. The church must cast the gospel message in thought forms that are distinctive to each new generation, and she, the church, must actively redirect the lines of secular thought Godward. Christian thought and spirit must not be bifurcated, resulting in an emphasis on one to the neglect of the other. The church's sons, illumined by the beatific and gifted in thinking skills, must extend the lines of biblical truth into the dark world of philosophy, secular philosophy, and indeed into all branches of human learning. I know this is a disputed one that maybe some scholars would disagree with me, but at least the mainstream view is that many of Martin Luther's hymns were originally German bar songs, including A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. That is what?
The tuned one.
Yeah, the tune. Sorry, not the words, the tune. Yeah, that's the music. Yeah. Yeah, so he's taking tunes that the drunks are singing in the pubs, and then he's turning them into these hymns that we still sing today. And then, so what's he doing? He's redeeming what's out there, but filling with Christian content. So a few examples. You see this many, many places in Edwards to different degrees. Three of the most notable to me, religious affections that Jesse talked about earlier this morning, the language of sensory perception of a new sense of the heart of Christian experience being more like tasting a pineapple rather than learning a new fact, just, and it's been documented by many scholars. This is just straight out of John Locke. This is straight out of John Locke's view of how human beings gain true knowledge is primarily through sensory experience rather than through abstract ideas that come into a blank slate. And so one of the things that Edwards still means, very Christian things, but it's everybody in the day is thinking about John Locke, thinking about empiricism, and many people mistakenly think that Edwards is a Christian empiricist in the sense of kind of selling out that worldview. He's not saying empiricism gets some really legitimate insights that we are not just reducible to, but not even primarily people who just abstractly consider, but our sensory perception of the world has a lot to do with why we think and act and feel the way we do. And so in religious affections, he commandeers this language, but he inserts the Christian life into it. End of creation, I talked about this earlier. If you listened to my talk this morning, and then you went home and you tried to read The End for Which God Created the World, you'd be like, what was he talking about? That's nowhere in Edwards. And the main reason is because Edwards is using, here's just a couple, Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle, if you would read, uses all this language about subordinate ends and ultimate ends and all these things that if you go and you read Edwards, he's got all the language there. So he's talking about God's purpose in the world, but from an Aristotelian standpoint, ends, purposes. The Euthyphro dilemma. Anybody remember Euthyphro from one of Plato's dialogues? Euthyphro was the young man who's very zealous for justice, and he's so zealous for justice that he's taking his own father, who's a criminal, to jail. He's turning his dad in. He's so zealous for justice. And Socrates meets him along the road and begins talking about, you know, what is justice, all these things. And he gives him the Euthyphro dilemma, which is an action right because God commands it, or does God command an action because it's right? And the dilemma is, on both of those, it seems to be bad news to say it. That if God commands something because it's right, it seems like there's a higher authority in the universe than God. That God himself has to submit to a standard that we can perceive and access by our reason, apart from revelation, say, and God, and this is in the intuitions of modern Westerners, that God must submit to moral standards that we can directly perceive. So, that's where most of the Enlightenment went. On the other hand, if you have the strong view that God something is right because God commands it, it makes it seem like God could say, you shall rape your neighbor, and that would have been virtuous just because God said it. And so morality becomes arbitrary. And what Edwards argues in the book is what the classical Christian tradition was, is that morality flows out of a Trinitarian relationship. And so God is not subject to it in the sense that it's not external to him, but rather his commands reflect his character, and his character is always in accordance with what he commands. And so on the one hand, it's not outside, but on the other hand, it's not arbitrary. It's flowing out of something that's there. But it's like, throughout the book, he brings in something that you see in much Enlightenment philosophy of the day in moral ethics, which is a third, what Edwards calls a disinterested ideal observer, who has omniscience and perfect goodness, and who looks upon the whole universe, and who weighs truth claims and moral claims. And that's the classic, there is a standard outside of God that even God has to submit to. And Edwards uses it. And it sounds like, so you're saying God has to submit to this higher standard? But then he immediately prefaces it by saying, no such figure exists or could exist because God is that person. But he talks in that language for them. And others, that the first section of the book is Ramus logic. Petrus Ramus was a famous logician back in the day. And it's what today in philosophy would be called something like foundationalism, that you start with certain self-evident a priori truths that no reasonable person could deny. And we do this in American culture. The Constitution starts with, or sorry, the Declaration of Independence starts with, we find these truths to be self-evident. And there's no argument for it, that human beings are equal, they have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And then the argument of the rest of the Declaration of Independence is on that foundation. But there's no argument for it. We all agree on this. And this is where postmodernism has collapsed modernism. It's self-evident to most human beings that all people are equal? That they all have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I mean, the founders owned slaves. It wasn't even evident to them. This is to say, foundationalism is no longer in vogue, but Edwards knew it wasn't a day. So what he does is, he takes truths that anybody would agree with in that day, says, okay, for the sake of argument, let's just assume this. Now, for instance, God is self-sufficient, that he's eternal, things like that. And no one, even deists, would doubt these. And then from them, he logically deduces propositions that lead him to the biblical view. And so he's talking in their language, but he's arriving at Christian views. And it's almost, you can, and some people think it's true, it's almost a little dishonest in the sense that Edwards clearly arrived at the views he's arguing at independently of the arguments, but rather got it from Scripture, and then he's translating it into the philosophy and the logic of the day. So many places say in the end of creation, the nature of true virtue, he explicitly says this in a personal letter. He's going after Francis Hutcheson, another moral theorist of the day, virtue ethics, in which the moral dues that you owed another human being, it was almost calculated, like calculus, that you added up their place in society, their being. So if it was a king, you owed him more than a peasant. And then you also owed up his moral beauty. So is he generous? Or does he cheat on his wife? And you took this kind of moral and greatness category, and you almost like combined them together, and you added it up, and that's how much you owe that person morally. And Edwards says, God is infinitely perfect, and he's infinitely beautiful. You owe him infinitely in your life. And so in the nature of true virtue, it says there's an infinite obligation that human beings have morally to God that he deserves from us. And he's using categories that people might say, oh, no, it's not what I meant by that, but it is what you meant by. That's how you guys talk, and now I'm talking like you. And so just to say, I could give many more examples. The examples actually are not the important part with Edwards, because none of them would work today. No one talks like this today anymore. No one holds these assumptions anymore, which is one of the reasons that if you read Edwards and you try to directly give him to people in his philosophical works, it doesn't work. It's like taking a Latin text and giving it to a person who only knows English. It's just, it doesn't help because that's not the language anymore. But Edwards does give principles of his translation that are helpful. So let's end with this, and then we can have some good discussion, hopefully, about what this might look like for us. Some principles that flow out of Edwards, that flow out of the Scriptures, that flow out of the early church, that this is the dynamic. The first principle I would draw is this. Christians, not just theologians, not just pastors, Christians in general need to be bilingual. And this, by which I mean they need to speak the language of Christianity fluently, but also the language of their culture fluently. They cannot speak one or the other. One of the things that is, just from a sociological point of view, I don't know how you could deny, we live in a culture as it becomes more and more fiercely divided geographically, socially, politically, religiously between extreme conservatives and extreme liberals, different parts of the country, different politics, everything. We increasingly live in a culture that no longer knows how to talk to each other because we do not have shared languages anymore. That the assumptions and the languages and the beliefs are so radically different between two segments of our population that the other one doesn't know what to make of this, and then this one doesn't know what to make of this, because it's like, you know, it's like England and France talking to each other if no one knew the other language on each side. And so one thing, and this might sound a little unfair, and in some ways it is, we have to do better than the world. The world can get by without knowing our language, and they do. We cannot get by without knowing their language. And so this is kind of unfair that we have to be bilingual. We have to be able to speak both. You probably feel it's enough to just try to study your Bible and get to know what Christianity is and know Christian theology well enough. And now here I am saying you need to know the world really well too. But that's the task. That's the task, to become all things to all people, which again, to go back to what I mentioned earlier, is one of the reasons that Tim Keller is so effective, not just overall, but with unbelievers who are not sympathetic to Christianity and their temperaments and their personalities, because he speaks their language. He quotes the New York Times Book Review. He quotes the secular philosophers, and it's something that we need to be able to do well. So we need to be fluent in both the biblical narrative as well as the secular idiom of the day. And I would go further and say that both of these texts, if you think of them as this text that you're reading, they have to also be understood on their own terms. On both sides, there's nothing worse, especially if you're passionate about a viewpoint, than if you're a really passionate conservative, hearing a liberal try to restate your views. Or if you're a liberal, hearing a conservative say, here's what you really believe, straw man, knock it down. They're like, that's not what I believe at all. You need to understand it on its own terms from the inside. And this is what Edwards does. Edwards really gets the philosophy of his day. Paul really understands wisdom of Solomon. He's not, you know, reading it once and then saying, oh, this is what it seems to mean to me, so now I'm going to run with it. They saturate themselves in it. They immerse themselves in it. So we have to be deep, saturated in both worlds, yet also able to distinguish them. And then this leads into the second principle, that even though we need to know equally well both worlds, that there is the question of authoritative direction, that these two narratives, these two construals and interpretations of reality that the Bible and our culture give, they don't hold equal weight for us either. We know the gospel is right and that our culture and its chief idolatrous aims and desires is wrong. And so, what this means is that the story of the gospel, even if we're not using the language of the gospel, the storyline takes precedence and has authority over what the culture says. I wish I would have included it, but Hans Frey taught at Yale Divinity School for many years. George Limbeck followed him. And Hans Frey coins this term that he called the Great Reversal. And what he meant was, even when Christianity was not entirely believed by everyone in the populace, the mass imagination of Western culture for hundreds of years was people looked at the world through the basic contours of the Christian gospel in this storyline, creation, fall, redemption, future hope. And what he says was it became the case, especially during the Enlightenment and following, that people now read the Bible through the cultural storylines. So we want to historically, critically tear it apart. We want to take sociological tools and say, you know, Jesus said this because his mom didn't like him enough, or Paul said this because he hated women. And we want to interpret the Bible like that. And so we look at the Bible through cultural lenses rather than looking at our society through biblical lenses. And so one thing is just that there is a one-way direction between the biblical storyline and the culture. Not to say that we can't learn from our culture, but to say all the essential things about human reality we're taking from the gospel, and that stands with authority, and it critiques our culture. We don't say, well, you know what? Our cultural sentiment today is this, therefore the gospel's wrong, and you begin to do that. That we don't do that. So one way to say is Christians have to prize and value both faithfulness and creativity. This is why Christians can't just have an unlimited valuing an unlimited valuing for academic freedom. There are certain things you just cannot say if you're a Christian. You cannot drop certain beliefs. On the other hand, it matters how you say the beliefs. It matters how you communicate them. You need to be creative. And Edwards was that. And holding that intention and balance is difficult. Another way to put it is that we need to give a linguistic priority to our culture, but an epistemological priority to the gospel. That we know God through Christ and the scriptures, not through the New York Times, not through your conversations with your friends, not through third grade history class. We know God through the gospel, but once we know God through the gospel, we're going to translate it into all those things and talk to them in that language. How other people come to know God will be through us, not through the Bible. Now, once they come to know God through us, then they'll start reading the Bible for their own. But there's going to be that indirect step, as there was for... If you did not grow up in a Christian home like me, there is always that indirect step. So to say that linguistic priority for culture, epistemological, how you come to know the things you know, goes to the gospel. Then lastly, I mentioned this earlier, but just to be aware that Christianity holds to both creation, everything in reality is good, but on the other hand, fall, everything is corrupted to some extent. We approach it wrongly. And that leads us to believe, and I think that's true, that every culture, every generation, the gospel will affirm certain values and sentiments and feelings and ideas within it, and also condemn and criticize and say no to others. And so, for instance, one that we see at Harvard where I work is when we talk about social justice, people listen. Because that is a value, that is a human value that honors God. Now, the way that unbelievers approach it is not sufficient. It's not okay. But it's something that you don't want to say, you know what, God wants you to really stop caring about poor people and believe in Jesus. That we're not saying that we're affirming social justice is all over the Hebrew prophets. But then we're also going to mean something different by social justice. And when we get into it, we're going to start going other directions with it too. But on the other hand, there are things, one notable one would be the sexual practices and intuitions of our culture, where you can't say anything but just no to a lot of it. And so you can talk in their language, you can try to get inside it, but just there's certain points you cannot bend. And so just to be aware of this, three modern writers, so I've mentioned a couple of these already, where I find this balance, and all three of them are listed in the recommended reading. Andrew Walls, the missiologist, talks about, these are his words, his phrases, the tension in the gospel between what he calls the indigenizing principle and the pilgrim principle. It's so helpful that when the gospel comes into a culture, it wants to dress up in that culture. It wants to do that. But on the other hand, it's still in exile there. It's not like everybody else who's wearing those clothes. It's a stranger in a common land. And so we're always, to some degree, singing the Lord's song in a foreign land. But we're singing the song in the language of the foreign land. And so we're seeking the welfare of the city. Leslie Newbegin talks about, he was a missionary for the first half of his adult life in southern India. And then he came back as an elderly man and became a world-class academic in England. And one of the things he talked about, and this is the theme of all of his books and what's so brilliant, is he had a new perspective on Western culture when he came back because his eyes were trained to interpret Western culture the way he was looking at Indian culture, which is from the lenses of the gospel, saying there's a lot of stuff going on here that just is not right. But there's also things where you see the reflection of God's image in this culture still. And so what he did was, you know, he challenged Christians to take the lens of the gospel and be able to look at your own culture the way that you would look at Africa or South America if you went there as a missionary. And because the danger for us today often is just we assume a thousand things we've never thought about, and we just assume it's okay, or that it's in line with Scripture or in line with God's purposes, or that it's wrong when maybe it's not. And that's not something that we should, it's not a hill we should die on. So being foreign and familiar with a culture at the same time. And Miroslav Wolf, the Croatian theologian, wonderful book, Exclusion and Embrace. He's talking more culturally and relationally, but I think it holds just as true intellectually, that there's, the gospel always brings exclusion. You're always excluding certain things that are contrary to God, but also embracing at the same time. There's always, and he especially loves to use the character of Abraham in the Old Testament, that Abraham was called to go to a new land, but he retained his identity in God. And he says, for us, the distance is not a geographical one or a sociological one. We're not leaving our language or going to a new state, but rather within the culture itself, we no longer give our loyalty to the things that the unbelievers around us do. So I still talk like all my friends growing up, but I live for something fundamentally different than all my unbelieving friends do now. And so I am radically estranged from them in some ways, but I dress and I look and I talk in the same ways that they still do. And so departure and remaining. And lastly, here's a great principle, and you can encourage your pastors in a loving way to strive for this. C.S. Lewis says in an editorial to the Christian Century, an essential part of the ordination exam for pastors before they get into the pulpit ought to be a passage from some recognized theological work, Edwards, Calvin, whatever, set for translation into vulgar English, just like doing Latin prose. Failure on this exam should mean failure on the whole exam. You don't get ordained. It is absolutely disgraceful that we expect missionaries to the Bantus to learn Bantu, but never ask whether our missionaries to the Americans or the English can actually speak American or English. Any fool can write learned language. The vernacular is the real test. And I think there was a lot of wisdom there. And that's, again, why you see the brilliance and the effectiveness of a Tim Keller, who was faithful and creative at the same time. So we have plenty of time for Q&A now. Nathan.